I am Kathy, as David said, and I've been a member of this community for, gosh, a long time, over 10 years. Started when we were still in the school. I joined staff more recently, probably about a year and a half now, after a long career in banking. And we're in one of those folks that needs this business card. We were one of these folks. I mean, my husband Pete and I mean, we hadn't been in church in probably 30 years before Crossroads. I mean, been a long time. And my, how both of us grew so much in being here. And we got here because we both had a business associate that told us about Crossroads and invited us to check it out. And I would have never gotten introduced to God the way I've gotten introduced to God, nor would I have grown as much as I have grown if it hadn't been for that. So there's probably more Kathy and Pete's out there that need that invite. So join me in making that happen. We've been talking about the good life. This is the sixth week of an eight-week series. And we've been talking about how hard it is to describe the good life in words. We can see the effects of it, and we've been using Paul's words. Paul was an early church leader who wrote lots of the New Testament. And he, in his letter to the Galatians, he talks about the effects of the good life. He says, the fruit of the Spirit, it's love and it's joy and it's peace, it's patience and it's faithfulness and it's kindness and gentleness and goodness and self-control. And that's the effects, but it's hard to describe what it is. We're going to take another look at it this week. And we're going to look at John's record of Jesus' second miracle. And if there was a headline for this story, this would be it. If you want the good life, take him at his word. Take him at his word. John challenges us in this story that Jesus' words, if we believe them, can actually be a gateway for us into the good life. The good life can open up through his words. Now, words. Words can be powerful. Words can also be pretty empty. In fact, we're barraged by words. USA Today Money said last year, the average American, that means us, we receive 5,000 marketing messages a day. A day. Yikes. No wonder we're numb. Well, and we're not just numb, right? We become suspicious of words. I mean, we're always kind of looking at, okay, what's the marketing spin on this, right? Commercials, politician speeches, even the news. If we're honest, we don't really believe most of what we hear. It goes right by us. We don't remember it, let alone act on it. But if you're like me, I bet there are some words you do remember. And it's probably not the stuff you heard on a commercial. Sometimes words can be really sweet. And somebody may have either said something to you or written something to you, go with me now, remember, that was really nice. It was really a sweet thing to say. And you can remember those words. I have a couple of those. On long, dark nights, I'll pull them out. I remember them. You also probably have some words that you remember that really stung, that hurt. And you can probably remember the exact words of that too. I know I can. In fact, I can remember in my early 30s, I was working in the human resource department. Now look at me now, right? Early 30s. That's remembering those words for a long time, right? And my boss left. So my career goal at that time, what I wanted was I wanted to be the head of a human resource department. So I thought, good opportunity. My boss leaves. I'm running the department on an interim basis, right? this could be a great chance. But I had kind of this feeling in my gut that I probably was not going to get the nod for this job. Because it was a senior management position. And when I looked at the senior management, there wasn't anybody that looked like me there. I mean, they were all white, yeah. They were all old, and they were all male. But I thought, you know, I'm not going to let him just ignore me. I'm going to at least force him to say no. So I did. I asked for an interview, and I got it. And as the interview finished, these are the words that I still can remember. How many years later? CEO, pretty tall guy. And I could tell the conversation was over. He got up, stood up. I stood up too. And he came and kind of put his arm around me. And I mean, he said these words with affection. I mean, he wasn't being mean or nasty or anything. He just said, Kathy, you're not going to get this job. I'm not going to get you this job. He said, you're a little girl. And if I gave you this job now, what would you do for the rest of your career? Ouch. I mean, I can laugh at it now. But I mean, at the time, I mean, those words, they fired me up. And I'll tell you what, I think the reason I remember them is that door closed on that opportunity. And actually, it was the best no I ever got in my career, actually, because another door opened in a totally different aspect of the business that actually was a lot better for me and a lot more opportunity. And shortly thereafter, my career took off. And I think that's probably why I remember those words. I remember them because it was a significant moment. It was a career-changing moment. It was a life-changing moment for me. And those words always stay in my head. I told you that John's headline today is Take Jesus at His Word. And I'm always surprised that in John's account of Jesus' life, that he only includes 7 miracles. Now, by most accounts, John, who wrote the biography of Jesus, and there were 4 biographies of Jesus, you know, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and John kind of took a different angle. And many, many people say that John was probably Jesus' best friend. So John really understood Jesus. He understood him in a way that maybe nobody else did. And I mean, he saw all the miracles Jesus did. I mean, Mark, in his gospel account, I mean, he has 5 miracles in the first chapter. And John chooses 7 in the whole record. So clearly, John didn't choose those 7 by accident, right? And every time he talks about a miracle, he does the same thing. He gives us the historical account of what happened. But then what he does is he takes us beyond that to the story behind the story, and he uses those miracles as a sign. He calls them signs because they point to something. They point to a spiritual reality that he wants us to understand about God. It might point to something about God's character. It might point to something about his kingdom. It might point to something about what the good life is. John tells us later in the same gospel that the reason that we can take and trust Jesus' word and that we don't have to discount it like it's another marketing spin piece is because of what Jesus said. And this is what he says in John 8:28. He says, I do nothing on my own, but I speak just what the Father has taught me. I mean, Jesus is saying that the reason you can believe him, you can trust him, trust his word, is because he has authority, and the authority he has is from the Father, which means he can speak truth. Okay, let's look at this story. When Jesus arrived in Galilee, the Galileans welcomed him. I mean, they had seen all he had done in Jerusalem at the Passover feast, for they had also been there. And once more he visited Cana in Galilee, where he had turned the water into wine. And there was a certain royal official whose son lay sick at Capernaum. And when this man heard Jesus arrived in Galilee from Judea, he went to him and begged him to come and heal his son, who was close to death. I think one of the reasons John includes this story as one of his seven is because it gives him an opportunity to paint a spiritual reality about how Jesus saw power and authority. So the first lesson, if we want the good life, we need to recognize the power structure. John says this guy is a royal official. If he's a royal official, he works for the king. He has power, he has authority, he has a position with some clout. And he probably has all the privilege that goes with that position, right? I mean, he has what we would define from a worldly perspective as the good life. He probably has a nice house, he has a sweet chariot, he has lots of food in the refrigerator. If he's a wine drinker, he's got lots of wine. We find out later in the story he's got servants. I mean, my gosh, he probably even has healthcare benefits, you know? The guy has the good life. He's also a man of authority. He knows what it's like to give orders. He knows what it is to have people follow him. Now, John doesn't tell us much about this guy. I mean, he doesn't even tell us his name. He just calls him the royal official. We do know something about him, though, because we know something about his boss. See, because if he was a royal official, he worked for the king, and the king at the time of Jesus' life was Herod. And we know that Jesus got brought before Herod right at the end of his life. You know, he'd been sent to Pilate, and then when Pilate figured out that he really was a Galilean, he thought, oh, I don't want to deal with this guy. We'll ship him to Herod. Well, Herod didn't have that attitude. Actually, Herod was pretty excited to see Jesus. He wanted to meet him because he had heard about everything he had done. He thought, wow, maybe this is my chance to see a miracle. So he's excited. Well, Herod doesn't get his miracle. I mean, Jesus is before him, and he doesn't even speak to Herod. He doesn't even say a word. So Herod, he's pretty embarrassed. I mean, here he has legal authority over Jesus. Jesus won't even talk to him, let alone perform a miracle. So he gets angry. He beats him, he scourges him, and he says, Pilate, you can have him back. Now compare Herod's approach to Jesus with the guy who works for him, this royal official. Herod tried to exert his force to get Jesus to do and to speak what he wanted. This royal official, he's in Capernaum, which is 20 miles from Cana, and he hears that Jesus is there. And he must have thought through what his options were. He thought, well, he, just like Herod, he had legal authority over Jesus. I mean, he could have summoned Jesus to him. He could have summoned him and said, hey, come to Capernaum. Or he could have used force. He had the authority to do that too. He could have sent soldiers to Cana and gotten the soldiers to bring Jesus back. And in fact, it would have been a whole lot more to his advantage to do that, right? His son's dying. If he leaves Capernaum, he may never, ever see his son alive again. But he doesn't. He doesn't stay. He doesn't exert his authority or his force. He actually goes. In fact, John says he went to Jesus. He runs to Cana. I mean, it's 20 miles. He runs there, and he begs Jesus, come back with me. Come back with me. My son is close to death. See, by running to Jesus, what this official is doing is he is letting Jesus know that he recognizes that Jesus has a power and authority that is different than his, and that his power, Jesus' power, not his, is what really matters in this circumstance. Now, Jesus had a real interest in teaching us about power and authority, because we already know he said, I have power and I have authority because of who my Father is. And I can speak the truth and I can have confidence. But Jesus knew he was leaving soon, right? So he wanted to get his disciples to understand what kind of authority he wanted, because he wanted to give his authority to them. And by giving it to them, guess what? He's given it to us, right? And so he wanted them to understand what he meant by power. So Matthew actually records a really good conversation between Jesus and his disciples around this very topic. Let's look at what he says. He says, you know, the rulers of the Gentiles, they lord it over others. And their high officials, they exercise authority over them. In fact, Jesus is painting a picture of what authority looks like, which is still probably pretty true in this world, right? You have this triangle, you have the people at the top who exert authority and get what they want by exerting pressure on people with less power. Now, I got a really good lesson once about use of power and authority. See, as my job got bigger at U.S. Bank, I had responsibility for a lot of different markets. I had responsibility for all the branches throughout the country where U.S. Bank operated. And part of my job was that I would do market visits. And it was a big deal. I mean, when I would do a market visit, the staff of that market, I mean, they'd get ready for me. I mean, they'd make sure I could meet with all their top customers. I'd meet their top employees. So I had a chance to spend some time with them and understand who they were. If there was a branch that was having problems that wasn't growing, we'd meet with the team, we'd strategize about what are the obstacles, what do we need to do, how can we get the business growing again. And then if they wanted the company to spend extra money in their market, they made sure I got to all the locations where they might want future sites because they wanted my support. So when I did a market visit, it was a big deal. One time my boss decides to come with me. That made it an even bigger deal. All right, so we fly in. We went to St. Louis, actually. This is the what I can remember so clearly. And it was summer, so it was about as hot in St. Louis that summer as I think it's hot this summer. I mean, it's just sweltering there. And the regional manager picks us up from the airport, starts driving us around to all the branches. And I can remember we got out of the car at a branch, a big urban branch in St. Louis. For those of you who know St. Louis, it's on North Kings Highway. So, you know, right in the heart of the city, big parking lot, big old building. Richard gets out of the door. We start walking towards the branch. And he starts, like, picking up the McDonald's bag that, you know, our customer had nicely left for us in the parking lot. And then a little bit later, he picks up the soda cup, you know, and it's half full of soda. He drains it out. He's carrying this in his hands. And then we're just about ready to go into the door, and he gets on his knees. And I mean, this guy's kind of like a $1,000 Italian suit kind of guy, on his knees on the asphalt in St. Louis, because he'd spied this beer can, you know, behind the shrubs, and he's down there, and he's plucking it out of the shrubbery, drains it, and then he walks into the branch. He doesn't say a word about the trash. Greets everybody, heads to the staff kitchen, ditches the trash, washes his hands, and then he does something unexpected. Because see, in the branch world, the branch manager's at the top. And here you have the muckety-mucks. I mean, we were the muckety-mucks, you know? So you got the CEO and the executives, the regional manager, all descending on this branch. The branch manager's at the top. But Richard doesn't even go to his office or say hello. He goes right to the teller line. Because see, in a branch, the tellers were at the bottom of the pecking order. And he starts waiting on customers, right with the tellers. And in between customers, I mean, they're yucking it up, having the best time, because he says, I used to be a teller, and I was the only guy on an all-female teller line, and let me tell you my woes of abuse from all these ladies. Well, you know, I'm not sure Richard knew he was modeling to me what Jesus wanted us to understand about power, but he was. Because in essence, what Jesus did is he took that triangle of authority in the world and he just flips it on its head. He just totally reverses it. And he says, huh, you know how the Gentiles do it, but I'm going to give you authority, and you are not going to do it that way. Not so with you, he says. If you want to be great, you'll put yourself at the bottom of the triangle, because that's where I am. You put yourself at the bottom of the triangle and you serve. Okay, thanks for camping out with me for a minute on this whole power authority thing, because I think that it's a big piece of what John's trying to communicate to us in the story. But we'll go back to the story now. And remember, royal official in Capernaum, son is dying, Jesus is in Cana, he runs to him, begs him to come. Now, what does Jesus do? How does he respond? This is what he says. He says, unless you people see miraculous signs and wonders, you will never believe. Now, see, when this royal official came to see Jesus, he was a big deal. He was a big shot, so crowds start gathering around. They want to see what happens. And so Jesus addresses the royal official, but he also talks to the crowds. And what he's really saying is, you only believe if you see me do something special. I want you to believe in me for who I am. I want you to believe in me because of where I come from. I want you to believe in what I say because I have authority from my Father. And you can trust that source. You can trust it. You can trust me. That's what he's saying. I want you to, that kind of belief. Now, the royal official, he's not put off by Jesus' comments. He's persistent. He asks again with respect from a low place, and he calls Jesus sir. He says, sir, come down. Come down before my child dies. And you can see what Jesus says. Jesus says, go. Your son will live. Jesus is challenging him. He's saying, okay, believe in me, not what you see. I mean, he doesn't like wave his arms, do any hocus pocus. I mean, he didn't do any of that. He says a simple word. He says, go. Now, he chose the right guy to do this with, right? Because this is an official. He has authority. He knows what it's like to give an order and have somebody act on it. So this official is going, what? I come all the way here. I run to get you. My plan is to get you back, get you in front of my son. And you're telling me just to go? I mean, come on. I mean, think about what was going through this guy's head. He's probably thinking, okay. Do I try to persuade him? Do I try to use my authority to convince him to come? Do I try to force him to come? And he doesn't do any of that. Yeah, it was crazy. He says, go. And this guy went. And that 20 miles back had to be agony for this guy. Wondering, oh my gosh, what's he going to find? Because see, death was on the other side of that. And if he was wrong, and if Jesus wasn't right, then he just made a big mistake because he didn't have any recourse, right? He didn't have a second chance at this. His plan was to get Jesus in front of his son, and Jesus wasn't cooperating. And he's agreeing to trust him and just go. Okay, John tells us what happens. The man took Jesus at his word and departed. And while he was still on his way, his servants met him with the news that his son was living. And when he inquired as to the time when his son got better, they said to him, the fever left him yesterday at the seventh hour. And then the father realized that this was the exact time at which Jesus had said to him, your son will live. Now, Jesus had healed many, many people. So the fact that he healed was not the big news here. It was that this healing was very unique. It showed the power of his words. He didn't have to go to Capernaum to heal this official's son. He could just speak it. And it was. Now, this royal official, he wasn't some big holy spiritual guy, right? I mean, he didn't have this special relationship with Jesus that he was kind of tuned in to him and he knew he could trust him. I mean, he didn't. I mean, he was a leader for sure. He worked for the government. He was probably a lot like all of us who are here. He did understand the power of giving an order, and he was willing to trust it. Now just think about the possibilities if we believed that Jesus had authority and power, and we believe what he said, we believed his word to us, think of the impact he could have in our lives today. I've had a couple of times when Jesus' word meant something to me. You know, the Bible's got his words in it, right? And it's available to any of us. Well, I have this little book. It's kind of ratty, so sorry, but it's got some miles on it. And I would write down, I got in the habit a couple years ago of writing down, like, words from the scripture when I was reading them that had a special significance to me. And for those of you who know anything about my story, you know my husband Pete, he got diagnosed with a brain tumor, and I stopped working, and I actually cared for him. I was his caregiver for a couple years. And during that time, any of you that are caregivers, you know this, it's really difficult. It's really, really difficult. And there was a lot of uncertainty in that whole journey, all these medical crazy things and, you know, trying to understand what Pete's symptoms were. And many times I felt totally lost. I mean, totally lost. And the words from Psalm 141, verse 8, I would just repeat them over and over to myself. And they're written here. And I dated it so I could remember what was going on in my life when that was happening. And it just says, keep my eyes fixed on you. Keep my eyes fixed on you. Keep my eyes fixed on you. I'd repeat that to myself. And by doing that, I did have a sense of direction. I could kind of regain it. I'd say, okay, I just keep my eyes fixed on you and take the next step. Or I also felt a lot of fear during that whole journey. I mean, a lot of fear. And the words Jesus said, when the disciples, remember, they're on a boat, they're in the middle of a big storm, they're like freaked out, and Jesus comes walking towards them on the water, freak them out a little bit more, and Jesus says to him, he says, take courage. This is in Mark. He says, take courage. It is I. Do not be afraid. Take courage. It is I. Do not be afraid. And I would tell myself over and over during that time when I was afraid with Pete, I'd say, okay, your presence is enough. That's all I need. Your presence is enough. Take courage. Do not be afraid. It is I. Now, you know, God can speak to us through the Bible. He can also speak to us through other people. And even sometimes, he'll speak to us when we're alone. And I actually had this experience. It was after Pete died, and I had started writing a book when Pete was sick. I actually was motivated to write it because I had researched all the guides on how to care for a brain tumor patient, and they were all pretty awful. They weren't very helpful. So I thought, well, that's one thing I could do. I mean, I could write a caregiver's guide to help other people you know, it would be a way to get some positive value out of a pretty awful situation, you know. So that's what I was originally doing. And Pete knew I was writing it. I used to have a little notebook in the kitchen. I'd always say, okay, come on, buddy, give me some good material here, you know. I want to give me some funny things. And he'd say, hey, include the clever things I say too, not just the funny things, you know. And so I'd been writing a book, and then I lost him. And it was probably 3 or 4 months after he died, and I mean, I was in a pretty dark spot. Oh gosh, I was just full of sadness and so much pain. And I felt so lost. I mean, I was trying to think, okay, what kind of future? I couldn't even imagine a future. In fact, I didn't even really know who I was anymore. And I remember having a conversation with God. And I was saying, okay, I can remember exactly where it was. It was in the morning where I was in the house, and I remember having, okay, now what's next for me? You know, I'm alone. I quit my career at the bank, so I don't have work anymore. I'm not even sure who I am, let alone what kind of future's ahead for me. So I said, what's next? And then I got this message that kind of popped in my head. Now, I didn't hear any voices or anything, you know. It wasn't anything audible. But I got this message that seemed like it was the answer to my question. And I'm going, is this you? God, is this from you? Because it was really clear. I mean, it was like, finish the book. And in fact, there was almost, I could almost hear a smile in the message, because it was like, and don't ask me again about what's next for you until it's done. So, I didn't know if that's from God. I mean, I could never prove it was, but I believed it was. I mean, when I got that message kind of in my head, it was like, I think this is from God. So I thought, well, okay, I'm going to do it. I'm going to take him at his word. I'm going to do it. So I got myself on a discipline writing schedule. Boom. The book changed. It's not a caregiver's guide. Because as I wrote it, I realized that what I was really writing was a memoir. And it was a memoir of Pete and my journey through those last 25 months of his life, of our life together. And I got that book done. It took me 2 years. It's 266 pages. It's over 100,000 words. And as a little side, it got published last year. Duh! I mean, crazy, crazy, crazy. Talk about how God is amazing. I mean, I didn't know how to publish a book, right? I'd never done it before. So I was told to buy this reference book that tells you how to publish a book. So I did. And there's 4,000 publishers in this book, right? 4,000. I find the one that's from Bethel, Ohio. Now, God's pretty amazing, right? Her daughter was born in the same hospital where Pete died. But that actually isn't the most amazing thing about that book story. The most amazing thing about that story is what happened to me during those 2 years while I was writing the book. Because I was in a dark place. I could not experience the good life at all. Sadness, pain. And slowly but surely, during those 2 years, that sadness and pain had disappeared. And I started finding that the good life started being available to me again. And wow, I started feeling joy. I experienced love again. I felt peace, patience, faithfulness, goodness. All of that becomes open to me. Now, the last line of this royal official story that John records, imagine this guy going home, seeing his son at the doorway waving to dad. Oh my gosh, the joy he must have felt, the thankfulness he must have felt. Oh my gosh. And John tells us he believed and so did all his household. So the last lesson about the good life is, if you experience it, tell everybody. I mean, this guy, he told his wife what happened. He told his other children what happened. He told his other servants what happened, and they told their children. And by the end of the night, his whole household was different. And remember, this guy's an official. He's a leader. He's a guy that has impact in the community. He has a reputation. So it's not just his household that's different. The whole city is different. Because he's talking about how Jesus of Nazareth, what he said to him, how he believed what he said and what he did, and what his experience was. And based on this experience of this official, other people believed too. So, here's my challenge for you this week. I want you to actually try to hear God's word for you this week. Okay? It might come through the Bible. If the Bible feels like pretty big and overwhelming, which it does, I think, then we have a nice little tool at Crossroads. You can go on crossroads.net, hit the daily, and it kind of takes the Bible and puts it into bite-sized pieces and kind of gives you a feeding every day. I get it on my phone, you can get it on your computer, and you can read that section of the Bible and get some suggestions about how to think about it. So it might come through the Bible or through the daily, all his word, that's available to us. Now it also may come, his word to you may come through other people. And if you've been around here for the last couple weeks on this series, I want you just to think about, are you remembering anything about the good life that's kind of struck you? I mean, I don't know about you, Andrea, but I remember Mingo's thing about the water wine. Do you remember that?
I like me some wine.
Yeah, me too. $27,000 worth of fine wine. I'm a wine lover. It's like, okay, I get that's abundance. That's abundance. Okay, God, you are abundant. I get it. And maybe I've been looking at you with eyes of scarcity. Or maybe you're a food person and it's Terry Phillips and he's talking about the chef's table at Boca. Remember that? And he says, trust the chef. Trust the chef. And don't be such a picky eater because you're going to miss the treats. Or maybe it was last week, if any of you were here last week with Mike, and he's talking about the rhythms that God has established for us and that we need to get aligned with those rhythms if we want the good life experience. And he says, he quotes Jesus and he talks about how we're supposed to work from rest, not rest from work. And that Jesus says, come to me, all you who are working hard and really tired. Come under my yoke. See, I'm a big, wise old ox, and I have certain rhythms, and if you get in step with me, the good life will come to you. Or maybe you'll have that experience like I had, where you got the small little voice in your head, and you're going, oh, is that you, God? Is that you? Well, if you think it is, take a chance. Take a chance. Take him at his word. Act on it this week. And see what happens. See what part of the good life opens up to you. And if it does, tell everybody. Tell everybody, because that's how we'll change this city.